Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producer is Dave Scott. And instead of Stephanie Collins, it's Fred Portnoy today. We're going to begin today's show, which I tape on Tuesday morning, with a continuation of another installment of Project 2025, the latest plot against America. And as you know, we've been sort of taking chunks and pieces of this fabulous piece by Ann Nelson from the Washington Spectator. And this is what Ann wrote, and I'm just going to take a small snippet. Project 2025 is the latest plot against America. It is actually the opening salvo of the 2025 presidential transition project. It's a comprehensive 900-page playbook, and it was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by 100 partner organizations. It's officially entitled Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. Project 2025 lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life, from women and the LGBTQ populations to environmental regulations to the concentration of power in the executive branch to promote an authoritarian regime. We are now up to the third of 10 things that you need to know about Project 2025. According to Project 2025's website, the recommendations constitute the first of four pillars of a 180-day plan. The implementation of the first step, or policy agenda, corresponds to Trump's promise to be dictator for a day and issue a sweeping round of executive orders. This would include the reimposition of Schedule F, removing civil service protection from tens of thousands of federal employees and replacing them with political allies. The second pillar, currently underway, is the compilation of a personal database to cast a net across the country to identify conservatives from all walks of life to serve the next conservative administration, known as LinkedIn for the Right. The third pillar is Presidential Administration Academy, also currently underway, which offers online and in-person certification programs for recruits to start implementing the president's agenda from day one. And finalmente, the fourth pillar, the 180-day playbook, involves a concrete, comprehensive action plan for each federal agency. This would be implemented by former members of the Trump administration, many of whom are listed as authors of chapters concerning their agencies, along, of course, with the newly recruited army of militants. Her translation, this, folks, is not a drill. The MAGA plan is already underway. And again, I'm going to recommend that you read anything Ann Nelson writes about Project 2025. And if you go to the Washington Spectator, you will be able to read quite a bit of it. And she joins me once a week because I'm going to beat this damn drum so you know a lot about it. I go to theconversation.com all the time. I'm probably one of its biggest supporters. I've been using it like for over a decade. And I love it because instead of going to a reporter or talking to somebody who's sort of a lens through which I can sort of speak, I go directly to the source, whether it's a professor or a PhD student. But now I'm going to both a professor and someone from sort of the media, but a columnist, but they have written a book together. And the article that drew me to this interview was entitled, Why Rural White Americans' Resentment is a Threat to Democracy. Rural white people have long held disproportionate power in U.S. politics, but polls suggest their commitments to the American political system are eroding. Joining us right now is both the author of the book that they have published together entitled White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Tom Shaler is a professor of political science at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. He is the author of The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House, Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win Without the South, and now, of course, and was the co-author with UMBC political scientist Tyson King Meadows of Devolution and Black State Legislators, Challenges and Choices in the 21st Century. And we are now being joined not only by Professor Shaler, but also by his co-author of White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy, Paul Waldman, who I've not talked to in forever. He is a former columnist with the Washington Post and is now currently an MSNBC columnist. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Oh, great, it's a pleasure. Here. I'm going to start with a little tiny story. And since I know Paul, Tom, you're going to have to forgive me. Tom, I've interviewed you, but Paul, I've actually known for quite a while, but haven't talked in forever. So I want to talk about rural white voters. And it's 1996. and I am just running for Congress. And the first request I get, I live in rural New Hampshire, and rural white voters are basically, they vote the same almost no matter where you are. If you look at rural New Hampshire, you look at rural Iowa, you look at rural Nebraska, you actually see that they check very similar boxes, okay? And their anger is very front and center. They tend to vote very conservative or Republican. Most of them have, you know, a gun rack in the back of their trucks, and they're not afraid of using their guns. Normally, it's like to shoot Bambi, but on occasion, it might be to do something else. So I am invited to my very first speech, and here is the name of the group. It's at the Barge Inn in Woodsville, New Hampshire, and it's called the Good Old Boys. That's the name of the group that's invited me, the Good Old Boys. And my staff look at me and say, "You're not going, are you?" And I went, "Hell yes, I am." So I walk into the Barge Inn in Woodsville. And I will tell you that every sandwich was on white bread. I will admit that, because I was kind of looking at what they were eating. And I had just run for governor on an income tax. And of course, everyone in the room hated me. Even though I was running for Congress, the room was just, you could just feel the anger about our liberal tax. And so as I get up to speak, I said, "So I think we need to clean house before I talk to you about running for Congress." I said, "Let's start by talking about the income tax, because that's all you see when I open my mouth." And then I proceeded to give them a knuckle sandwich about tax justice and how they were getting screwed by the property tax and paying anywhere from 20 to 30% of their income with property taxes, whether they lost their job or their partner died or they shut down the mills. I said, "You're just getting screwed and you think I'm your problem." All right. So after I sort of cleaned house, and then I went into why I was running for Congress. This is the part where I want people to know you need to go to rural America. You need to talk to rural America. You need to hear their anger, but they also need to hear you, because you actually have more in common than you know, because your anger is actually very similar, all right? And at the end of my speech, Paul and Tom, here's what happened. One of the guys at the back of the room raised his hand and he said, "So Arnie," he said, "I just got one question for you. You sure you ain't a Republican?" All right, listen to what he said. Now, I'm probably the liberal, most progressive person in my state, okay? I'm kind of the Bernie Sanders in a skirt. And yet, look what they heard. So as I realize you've written about rural white Americans and what I hear about the resentment, I guess, Paul, I'm going to start with you. I am afraid. I lost my race for Congress because of rural New Hampshire. I lost my race for governor in large part because of rural New Hampshire. I spent more time talking to rural New Hampshire than anyone, and I could sort of feel that resentment and anger. What I'm trying to figure out is, how do we not only address it, but how do we constantly send messages out to counteract the misinformation that they are fed every single day, hours a day, whether they're watching Fox or they used to listen to Rush or they're listening to Christian radio or whatever? How do we let them know that what is ultimately they're angry about and who they are angry at are actually the people that could help them, and the people they support are trying to screw them? So welcome to the program, Mr. Waldman.
Yeah, you mentioned about three or four different things there that are all really, really important, and I'll try to get to them all. The information environment is absolutely vital. And this is something that we think doesn't get enough attention when you're talking about this issue, that the kind of resentment that so many white rural people feel is often just taken as though it has only kind of organic sources. And there are real and profound problems in rural America. And when people ask, well, why are people resentful? They say, well, you know, manufacturing jobs have moved overseas. And there are a lot of deep problems in rural America. They were targeted for opioids by pharmaceutical companies. And they have, you know, their schools are not good enough. They're underfunded. And all those things are very, very true. And we talk about a lot of them in the book. But there isn't enough attention given to the kind of rhetoric that gets delivered to so many people all over the country, but is especially resonant in rural America, where the entire conservative media universe, Fox News, conservative talk radio, and Republican politicians are constantly telling them that they should be angry. And the source of their problems is college professors, snooty Northeastern elitists, immigrants, Black Lives Matter, and that's who they should blame their problems on. And of course, that excuses the very people who represent them and who are in charge in so much of white rural America. And we can talk about non-white rural America because that's important too. So that's an absolutely vital part of the story and something that that's really meaningful to understand. And as I say, there are deep problems in rural America. All those things are true. And there are reasons why they feel as though they've been left behind. But what Republicans have been very successful at is turning that just into an argument about identity, so that when people like you come to some of those voters and say, let's look at who really caused these problems and let's try to think about what the solutions might be, that there's a wall that goes up that says, well, no, you're a liberal. You hate me and you want to destroy my way of life. So I can't possibly vote for you. And that prevents people from hearing the kind of messages that you want to send.
Oh, so Tom, I want to bring you into this conversation because this is so important. And in this, the reason I focus on the media is obviously this is my job. Okay. This is what I've been doing my whole life. And I'm from a northern part of my state. I raised my children, Tom Shaler, in a town of 1,000 people. I was the first Democrat they ever voted for. The most conservative reactionary governor probably at that time in the world was a resident of my town. He used to refer to me as that woman. But you know, one of the ways I was able to convince my community that they could vote for this liberal Arne Arneson from New York? A couple of things. I gave birth to both of my babies at Cottage Hospital, not at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. Think about it, okay? Not only that, but they saw me scraping and painting my own house. Not only that, but they saw me repairing the sills myself on this 1838 farmhouse that was falling down. You know what else? When it was Christmas time, I went through 50 pounds of butter, made every kind of Christmas cookie you could possibly make, and invited the whole frickin' town. So I think part of the problem, Tom, is that not only have they also been ensconced with this constant media, but I think people that run for office, people that are elected officials, they haven't not only gone back to constantly say, let me go to your Rotary, let me go to your Lionesses, let me sit down and talk to you, get to know me. But then also begin to understand that not only, as he said, is that resentment legitimate, but when you realize that most farmers now are nothing more than slaves to the corporations that own their fields, they can't even repair their own tractors because they don't have right to repair. They don't have really good internet access. So they don't, so they look at what's going to be the future for their kids. I mean, when you look at all those things, if you don't talk to them about it, but the crazy and the conservatives do, they get to then redirect the anger away from who's actually causing the problem. And nobody has been there to say, wait a minute, maybe there's another road here you need to look down that will actually solve this problem. Tom.
Well, I think that's exactly right. As we say in the book, it wasn't liberal college, woke liberal college professors who poured mountains of opioids into rural America. And it wasn't Black Lives Matter that move jobs out of their communities or out of their state or out of the country. And it wasn't pink hat wearing feminists on the mall agitating for reproductive choice who've created this sort of out migration of young people who are leaving their rural communities, especially the best and brightest of them, and never coming home from the cities and suburbs because they can find a better life and livelihood there. And so it's easy to turn on Fox News or talk radio and find them redirecting the blame to convenient boogeymen of the month, rather than looking at the people who created a late stage capitalism drain. To that point, and to your point, we cite a study in the book that shows that rural revitalization, after looking at a variety of factors that worked and didn't work, the scholars in this study concluded that three things were necessary. One, you had to have reproductive choice and education for young women and girls so that they could become moms when they were ready, not when they got pregnant. Two, you needed rural broadband, which you mentioned, which is more expensive per person to deliver in rural America. But we did it for rural electrification last century. We can do it for broadband this century with the right public investments. And we are 100% behind that. Three, you need to have vital, well-funded public schools. Now, let's go through those issues real briefly and what Republicans' positions are on them. Let's give the Republicans a pass on choice as a moral issue. They're not going to support that. Okay, fine. That's an ideological issue. That's a moral. That's a maybe a religious issue. But look at the other two. You have Republicans in the pocket of the big telecoms who are fighting against local, small, rural, targeted broadband providers. I met with a woman. She lives in DC. She's got 26 permits to expand rural broadband in eastern North Carolina, and not all she does is fight with Raleigh and fight with the trade associations to try to expand rural broadband to communities that don't have it. And if you don't have broadband, first of all, you can't go to school during COVID. You can't interview for a job remotely, and you can't take a job remotely if you don't have quality broadband. And as we say, that smart young girl who at 16 realizes she can code could take a job in rural America remotely, or working for a defense contractor, or working for doing, service sector jobs for a big corporation, answering phones and dealing with customer service, and make a Dallas salary or a San Francisco salary or a New York City salary while still living in her rural community, which would make her among the wealthiest income and highest income people in her community because of the cost of living there, and could afford a nice house and good insurance and invest for her future and retirement. Third, of course, is public schools. And what we just saw, and give rural Republicans in Texas credit, Greg Abbott, in the pocket of the big voucher lobby, tried to push through a bill that would create vouchers so that rich people could pull their money out of public sector schools and send their privileged kids far away to some private school in San Antonio. And it was going to decimate the budgets of rural school districts. And Republicans in rural parts of the state joined with Democrats and defeated that bill. And what did Abbott do? He's vowed vindication and primarying and trying to attack Republicans who voted correctly to protect their local public schools. So on at least two of those three issues, even if we give Republicans an ideological and moral and religious pass on choice, on the other two issues, guys like Ted Cruz aren't trying to bring rural broadband, and they're not opposing these voucher programs. They're working for the big trade association corporations in the exact opposite directions that would lead to rural revitalization. And all they got to do is go home and say, "My pronouns are kiss my ass," as Ted Cruz says, and gin up the votes of resentful whites and blaming their problems on some, liberals, coastal elites who want to tell people that you can't call, somebody she, he, or they. It's an absurd attack and distract politics, and it's destroying the rural voters who vote overwhelmingly for those Republicans, and it needs to stop, Arnie.
So, Paul Waldman, what Tom doesn't know is we cover Texas every single week. Every single week, with a guy named Scott Braddock from something called the Quorum Report. And what is so amazing about Greg Abbott's fight for vouchers was he was never a voucher guy, but you can't be a MAGA Republican anymore without vouchers. Okay? He knew that rural, that the base of the Republican Party is rural Texans. He knew rural Texans hate it. Okay? And not only that, but what people don't understand is it's not just the rich folks in rural Texas, of which they're probably only a handful, could then use the vouchers to send their kids off to some private or parochial school, but it turns out not only are we talking about Friday Night Lights, it is the most important sort of community thing that happens, and it happens around schools. And it turns out, Paul Waldman, that the schools are the largest employer, stable employer in rural Texas. So not only are you decimating education, but you are decimating employment. And here's one more kicker, because remember, I used to represent I was the president of the largest poverty agency in my state. Coos, Carroll, and Grafton County, the three most rural counties. Do you know why they desperately needed prisons and schools and any kind of like public facility? Because the only people that had health insurance were people that were actually on some sort of state or local payroll, and they kept the hospitals open so the community could still have a rural hospital. So it isn't just about schools, everyone. It isn't just about vouchers, Paul Waldman. They're decimating them. And the irony is, these same Republicans will then be told who to blame. But those rural Republicans who were in the Texas legislature, they understood it was Abbott that was doing this. But Abbott understood he was going to pull a Governor Reynolds from Iowa and basically purge the Republican Party in Texas. And he was fairly successful, Paul. So I think, again, your book is so powerful. But look at who the enemy is. The enemy are the people you're voting for.
And I'm glad you mentioned healthcare because, we traveled around the country going to different kinds of rural places in reporting this book. And everywhere we went, healthcare access was something people brought up with us. We had a conversation with a county supervisor in a place, Northampton County in North Carolina, which is a majority Black county. And she said, "Not only do we not have a hospital in this county, we don't even have an urgent care center. If you break your ankle, you're going to have to get in your car and drive a half an hour to go find a hospital, let alone if you're having a heart attack." And it is a huge issue all over rural America. And what is the most important solution? The most important solution, as you say, is it's got to be public funds when you have a spread out populations. And so you look at the 10 states that have still not accepted the expansion of Medicaid in the Affordable Care Act. They are all states with significant rural populations run by Republicans, where the people who are the base of their power are the ones who are suffering most, because there have been almost 200 rural hospitals that have closed in the last 20 years. Medicaid is the lifeblood, because when you get people insurance, they can actually go to the hospital, and the hospital can get paid if they treat them. And their rural hospitals absolutely depend for their financial survival on Medicaid. And so you have these states like Texas, like Tennessee, that say, no, we are not going to accept that Medicaid expansion. We're not going to give our own citizens health insurance. Why? Because they want to give a big middle finger to Barack Obama. And they're punishing the very people whom they rely on for their power. And
can we say something else? No,
you're, everywhere in rural America.
Paul, they're not punishing, they're killing. I'm sorry. We have to stop being nice. It's not it is so destructive. The consequences are so enormous. We're learning the consequences from abortion, with all the women that now have to flee the state. Before abortion, they were closing rural hospitals. So if you have to travel miles for, you know, an abortion, think about it. You have a heart attack and you have to travel miles to find a hospital. Okay? And that happens more and more often to so many people. But Tom, the thing that's important about this article is about why you wrote it, because it is about a threat to what happens in the November election. It is about a threat to democracy. So can you quickly walk through the things that rural white Americans, of which basically they make up 75% of rural folks anyway, and they tend to sort of have a very interesting thematic approach to their resentment and democracy. So tell my audience, what are the things that we need to be concerned about?
Okay, so first of all, you might say, well, rural America is 20%. And when you take out the quarter of that that's non-white, you're only talking about 15% of the entire country that's rural and white. How are they such a threat? They're one out of seven people. But as everybody knows, and nobody's disputed, and we dedicated an entire chapter three, rural votes are overinflated by about 37% in the Senate, because the smaller and more rural states get their two senators, regardless of population, just like California with 39 million people only gets two senators. We know that because of the Electoral College, which takes your House delegation plus those two senators, that rural voters are overrepresented in the Electoral College, which is something you can just ask President Al Gore or President Hillary Clinton to testify about. And then finally, which we found, which was really fascinating, is that according to Bloomberg City Lab project, which classifies districts in six categories from purely rural to purely urban, is that there are more either purely rural or rural suburban mixed districts than there are purely urban or urban suburban mixed districts, even though they're by a 2-to-1 margin, 42 to 19%, even though more people live in cities than the country. And so because of gerrymandering, where we pack every minority and white liberal in the city into one district that's 90% Democratic, like look at what's going on in Alabama. So you get one black and white liberal district around Birmingham and so forth, and then you create six Republican districts elsewhere in the state. Rural voters are represented in the House too. So this is a government where on the national level, rural voters cast inflated votes. And so when we talk about the threats, we talk about their racism and xenophobia. We talk about their conspiracism. We talk about their anti and undemocratic sentiments. And we talk about their violence justifying attitudes. Rural voters are most likely to sort of explain away or justify or have an insurrectionist attitude toward January 6th, even though they weren't overrepresented actually on the Capitol on January 6th. We talk about these threats, and, you know, in the context of a president who's going to, if he gets reelected to a second term, Donald Trump will be on the strength in part of rural voters who, as you're pointing out apparently daily on the 2025 project, is about to deconstruct our democracy on the strength of those votes. We felt it was important to write this book in advance of 2024. And we did, and it's created a bit of a firestorm, and we do not apologize for that. It is a national conversation that needs to be had before it's too late.
Okay, so Paul, I've been doing talk radio since 1988. Can I tell you about one of my first shows? My radio audience was really, really interesting. It was before public radio had gotten up to the Upper Valley of Vermont and New Hampshire. So here is my audience. My audience consisted of, it consisted of the Dartmouth College professors and the White Mountain Militia. That was the arc of my audience, Paul, okay? And it was, but it was a gift. It was a gift because we talked to each other. And because we heard each other and we didn't have this Maginot line between us. So now what's happened? It's that all my White Mountain militia boys, now they go to their Newsmax and their, and formerly Rush and whatever. And all my Dartmouth professors, they go to NPR. Well, screw that. Because ultimately that just really continued to separate us. So we, this book is powerful. I've lived this book. I am this book. I am this book. You have no freaking clue. I mean, I had my first baby born without health insurance at Cottage Hospital. And then I had my second baby born with insurance. And here's what happened when I delivered it for the second baby. They were running up and down the halls of Cottage Hospital. She has insurance. She has insurance. I mean, Paul, you can't make it up. So what I only have a minute left. What do we do? What do we do? Their anger is legit. Please, everyone, their anger is legit. Their mills have shut down. Their farms have been taken over. They don't have the internet access. They don't have access to a doctor when they're sick. Their kids are fleeing. It's a short sprint. But is there anything that we can do between now and November that at least says we hear you?
Yeah, I think people like you are doing good work. There are a lot of progressive rural activists out there who are working really hard to try to change the conversation. And I think that's what you need to do, is a little bit of sort of meta communication. You have to say to those people who are resisting you, like, let's take a step back and look at what really has an impact on your life. And look at what you've been told by the people you keep electing. They don't want to take any accountability or any responsibility. Most rural places, you are represented, everybody from U.S. Senator all the way down to dog catcher, by a conservative Republican. What are they actually doing to improve your lives? And you can say, as a progressive, you know, you may disagree with me on some things, but let's take a look at the people who represent you.
Right.
What are they actually doing for you?
I need to let both of you go. You're coming back. You're coming back. I'm just telling you right now. You just have to come back, or I'm giving you a knuckle sandwich. The title of the piece, Why Rural White Americans' Resentment is a Threat to Democracy. Rural white people have long held disproportionate power in U.S. politics, but polls suggest their commitments to the American political system are eroding. We've been talking with Paul Wallman and Tom Shaler. They are the author of the new book, White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Gentlemen, thank you so much for doing this, and you are coming back. I'm just telling you. I'm not even going to ask. I'm just ordering.
Well, anyway. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're always happy to do it, Arnie.
All right. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. We will be right back.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy, stepping in for Stephanie Collins. As you know, we record our Wednesday show on Tuesday morning. We get to hang out with Mel Goodman a lot. Whenever I need to be sort of more clear-eyed about what's happening in foreign policy, I think for decades now, I've been turning to Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He's a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. He's a former CIA analyst. He is the author of the book, Failure of Intelligence, Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and a Whistleblower at the CIA. His most recent books are American Carnage, The Wars of Donald Trump, and Containing the National Security State. And I want to welcome him to the program. And he wrote a piece, everyone, that, you know, you look at the headline and I'm like, well, what could it be in here? And then I have to tell you, Mel, I read your article and I wanted to put my fist through the wall. So this is really wonderful that you wrote it and very, very accommodating that you should show up. And I want to welcome you back to the program and let everyone know that the title of his piece is Meet the Newest Apologist for Israel, Rear Admiral John Kirby. And you read that headline, you think, yeah, big deal. And then you read the article and you go, oh, God. Welcome back to the program, Mel. Thank you so much for writing this.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be with you, as always.
All right. So let's remind everyone, what is John Kirby's sort of newish role? Because you actually begin this way, because he is now the spokesman for the National Security Council. And I think people need to understand why he's now in this position where normally you would see some other press person be doing this, but they felt it was just too important and too complicated given what's going on in Gaza. But I'm sure it's complicated for anyone because I'm not sure what our position is anyway, except to support Israel. But explain a little bit about who he is and his role.
Well, Kirby has been a press spokesman at the State Department. He's been a press spokesman at the Defense Department, and he was brought in to be the press spokesman for Jake Sullivan at the National Security Council. But when the White House spokesperson, Karine Jean-Pierre, who's very young, very inexperienced, was having trouble handling questions on national security and foreign policy, they moved Kirby in to fill the gap there. And so he started taking questions on national security and foreign policy. And of course, those questions are now dominating the sessions with the press. I don't find him very sophisticated. I don't find him really capable of handling the press in any real fashion. But his apologia for Israel, one after another, in this crucial press conference that took place right after the tragic targeting of the Jose Andres's World Central Kitchen, I sort of gave away the game. There was a question about can't the United States get involved in a protective force for the aid workers? And Kirby's response was, well, they already have a protective force in Gaza. It's the Israeli Defense Forces.
Oh my God.
Well, does he really believe that? I know he's speaking for Joe Biden and he's speaking for Jake Sullivan, but does anyone really believe that the Israelis are the protective force? And then he mishandled a question on deconfliction. The problem is not that the Israelis have an inadequate deconfliction system in Gaza. It's that they don't want any deconfliction system Gaza. They had one in Syria over the years. They've had them in Lebanon over the years. But in Gaza, I still think they're determined to kill as many Palestinians as possible. And then the last straw in many ways was the question about violations of international law. And he said, well, the Department of State has looked into that and there have been no violations of international law. Well, there have been violations of international law day in and day out ever since the Israelis invaded Gaza and using the kind of weapons, including the 2,000-pound bombs that we're supplying in urban areas to destroy apartment buildings, to destroy high rises. So there's no concern about the Palestinians and the civilian community. And I noticed in the entire interview, Kirby never used the word Palestinian. He referred to civilians and aid workers. And
oh
this tragic thing in all of this, if those aid workers had been Palestinians, I don't know if we'd be even having this conversation. I don't know if anyone would have paid attention to it. It was because it was Jose Andres's group, and he is an amazing man. There's no question of that. And the fact that the aid workers basically came from countries that support Israel. They came from the United States. They came from Canada. They came from Britain. They came from Australia. These are supporters of Israel. And these are the very aid workers that the Israelis targeted and killed. And they can't say it was accidental. They can't offer the flimsy excuses that they've offered, because there were three cars in that convoy After they targeted the first and the survivors fled to the second car, they targeted the second car and then the third car until they killed all of the aid workers. So this is a terrible tragedy. Biden still hasn't demonstrated to me that this is a real tipping point. I know he had a harder phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu, but until we slow down the arms and even stop the arms, not just provide conditions, because the Israelis have never honored the conditions that we've put on them before. We know that from their fighting in Lebanon in 1982 and 1983, and they stayed around for 2 decades in Lebanon, violating the so-called conditions we put on the use of arms. So, can they be trusted? Of course not. Does Biden still trust Netanyahu? Apparently, he is. He's very frustrated. He's very perplexed. But what has he done to do something differently?
So, I'm going to read from your piece because I want people to hear every word that you wrote. And what sometimes when we talk, we give the headline, but we don't go into the detail. And one of the things that you pointed out was that once again, the worst of Kirby's remarks were not referenced in the Washington Post. Hear that, everyone? I just want everyone to know. You go to the Washington Post, they weren't referenced.
Or the
And
New
then,
York Times.
oh, the New York Times. Okay, I was getting there. I was getting there. Talk about the paragraph about what Kirby was asked about whether there should be a protective force for aid workers. So listen to this, everyone, please. One of Kirby's most offensive responses concerned a legitimate question regarding the possibility of the United States organizing a protective force for aid workers. Kirby did not believe the United States had a role to play in protecting aid workers because, now listen to this, the Israeli Defense Forces were providing that protection, close quote. In other words, the day after the Israeli Defense Forces demonstrated an appalling lack of responsibility in destroying three vehicles that were properly identified for a mission that had been coordinated with the Israeli officials, Kirby blithely cited the IDF, already responsible for the deaths of hundreds of UN officials and aid workers, as, quote, a legitimate protective force. Honest to God, Mel, I read that paragraph and I had to reread it to myself 3 or 4 times, okay? Because, so here's one of the things that really ticks me off. So I have been in a situation where I'm in the media and we're interviewing, different officials. What really ticks me off is how did he get away with saying that? And a dozen reporters didn't jump all over him. Because it is just, it is distortion. It's grotesque. It is appalling, the answer. It is so, not only does it lack sophistication, but it oozes dishonesty. I mean, I read this and then to find out that the Washington Post and the New York Times didn't even cover it really ticks me off. But there is no one sitting in those journalists who looked at him and just basically didn't take their shovel out and beat him up. Because I was just like, because I think we have to start holding ourselves accountable for what I think is an immoral response. And that was immoral.
Yes, and we are complicit. The United States is complicit in this war. We shouldn't try to deny that. And what's wrong with those press conferences is they're in there as individuals. They don't support each other. They don't follow up another person's question because they
No.
want their own limelight. It's a very narcissistic venue, as far as I'm concerned, and it doesn't get at these important issues that the mainstream media just doesn't protect. He even There was a reference made to by one of the journalists with regard to Netanyahu's remark about the World Central Kitchen, where Netanyahu, who's as callous and callow as anyone can be, said, "Well, things happen in war," and that was raised to Kirby as well. And Kirby said, "Well, I don't want to get into a tit for tat with the Israeli prime minister." Well, what are we afraid of with regard to the Israeli prime minister? My
Right.
fear with the Israeli prime minister is he wants this war. He needs this war. It's political protection, it's legal protection. And the question now is, now that he's bombed a consular building in Damascus, does he want to bring the United States into this war? I think he wants to draw the United States into a regional war. He's engaging in escalation to avoid his own political and legal problems. So he's provoking Iran to hit back. Iran really is almost compelled to hit back. It's obvious they don't want to. Iran doesn't want a war. They have a strategy of using proxies, and that's the way they're going to proceed. They're completely preoccupied with domestic issues, with corruption, with mismanagement, with sanctions. They have a certain amount of regional influence that they're trying to protect. And of course, we opened the door for them with this illegal and immoral invasion of Iraq in 2003. And I don't know if people understand that. If you look at the Middle East now, it's the Middle East that we created with an illegal war. And you look at countries like Israel and the United States and Russia thinking that military force can solve these problems. Problems are not solved with military force. Problems are created with military force. And I don't see any end to that unless we get serious with Netanyahu and behave like the major power that we are in our bilateral dealings with him. And we're hesitant to do it, particularly a Democrat.
Okay, so part of the shock of what happened on October 7th is that we have been told over and over again about how sophisticated the Israeli military is, how sophisticated they are. They have ears and networks everywhere. They're lethal. They know how to be strategic. They know how to eliminate, like, the top of a pinhead. And so, as I'm thinking about what happened with the World Central Kitchen, it makes no sense unless it was intentional. Because this is the most sophisticated military probably on the planet. And for them suddenly to say it was a mistake, there are no mistakes like this. Especially when they had three bites at the same apple and they killed and they killed and they killed and they had notification and they had identification. It blows my mind, given how much I've been told about the level of sophistication of the military. And then I want to go back to what this is the region that we have created. You go back to the Iraq wall. I'm going to go back to the election of Hamas. Let's remind everyone, Mel, that it was George Bush that insisted they have an election in Gaza. And
Yeah, that
Fatah
was,
was
by the way,
totally
that was
unprepared.
Condoleezza Rice's idea that she sold to George Bush.
Right. And we need to remind people, we forced an election. Fatah was not ready. I mean, I landed in Israel right after this election. Trust me on this one. And Hamas got elected in, what was it, 2006. And there hasn't been an election since. There hasn't been an election since. So you got George Bush basically getting Hamas elected. And then you've got Bibi Netanyahu sending money to make sure that Hamas stays in place and ignoring what they were told because they were warned about exactly what happened on October 7th. This is so outrageous. And if you actually read and saw all the component parts, you would be furious with the Biden administration for what they are supporting.
And now, when you advance forward, all of a sudden Hamas becomes that existential threat. Hamas is not an existential threat. Netanyahu allowed the October 7th invasion to take place because he
Yes.
didn't take the border seriously. He didn't take Hamas seriously. He allowed Qatar to pour all sorts of financial aid into the region. If Hamas is an existential threat, then what is the northern border with Israel and Lebanon with Hezbollah? What kind of threat is that? What kind of threat is Iran? The real threat to Israel is a domestic threat, and it's a two-part threat. Netanyahu and his right-wing cabinet, taking
Yep.
advantage of the ultra-Orthodox community that supports Netanyahu, and the internal threat that Israel has to deal with, that Netanyahu really can't handle because politically he's a dead man walking. When that war is over, he's gone.
Yeah, I know.
But I
I
don't
know.
see anyone stepping up to the plate who will be more progressive or be more liberal, because what has happened that has not been acknowledged by the mainstream media is that you've had a tremendous transition in Israel politically over the years, where the former influence of labor unions, of the left, of the progressives, has really been overtaken by the right wing and the ultra-Orthodox and the Haredim. And this is what Israel's going to have to contend with. As to me, a real existential threat to what is supposed to be a democratic and progressive country. And we have not acknowledged that.
So Mel, how did that happen? How did the conservatives get such a stronghold there? I mean, I keep thinking about there were so many times that we should have stepped in because your best friend is the one that tells you the truth, okay? And I look at the settlements and I look what's been going on with the settlements. We had so many opportunities to say, you break the law. You have all these illegal settlements. We cut our financial ties. There was, and it was clear. It wasn't sophisticated. It didn't require, oh, there are shades of gray here. No. This was illegal. This is what they were doing. They were like flipping the bird, and they kept expanding and expanding. And when we're talking about who's being, you know, who's being killed in Gaza, we better talk about the Palestinians who are being killed in the West Bank and in the settlements. I mean, as if their lives are being ignored. And we had an opportunity even before October 7th to draw a line, but instead we turned our back. And that just, I think, aided and abetted the conservatives and Netanyahu.
Well, the only president in the recent past who's been willing to deal with this on this basis is George H.W. Bush, who did cut off funding because of the illegal settlements. Oh. And Secretary of State James Baker made Benjamin Netanyahu persona non grata at the Department of State. He said he didn't want him in this building anymore because he was accusing the United States of lies in their foreign policy. Netanyahu has been a problem for the United States for 30 years, and we've never been willing to acknowledge that. Biden still thinks there's a friendship between Netanyahu and Biden. Netanyahu is using Biden. He's exploiting Biden. And when Biden went to Israel right after October 7th, it was clear that Biden was more disturbed by what had happened on October 7th than was Benjamin Netanyahu, who was seized on this opportunity to create a wider war and greater hostilities. Really, what I see is necessary is the United States and Iran have to begin a dialogue. Iran has indicated that they want this dialogue. They approached us in January for private and secret talks. It took us over a month to respond, and then we said we would only meet with them indirectly. I think Biden is so frightened by the election of November, he's afraid to reach out to Iran. Iran does not want a regional war. They don't want a wider war. They can't afford a wider war. Netanyahu's goal is a wider war, and a wider war that could drag in the United States. He's sort of escalating to nowhere. His escalation is not part of any policy. It's a disaster. And I thought what he did in Damascus was one of the most reckless acts that any Israeli prime minister has ever taken. It was comparable to the invasion of Lebanon by Sharon in 1982, which really did in the Begin government. So the Israelis have made so many poor strategic decisions. And as you say, we have never stopped to tell them that what they're doing is wrong for Israel. It's wrong for the stability of the area. It's wrong for the region.
But not only is it wrong for the region, I'm going to be selfish. It's wrong for us. Because look what's now happening as a result of what it's doing to Biden. Because it's doing to Biden, I mean, the young people and this isn't just people who are, you know, pro-Palestinian. These are young people who are looking at this humanitarian catastrophe and going, it's happening on my watch. It's happening with my president. This famine is happening and I have to own it. They are so appalled that it's beyond just even the comment of about a ceasefire. They are disgusted with what's happening here. So what is ultimately happening is you mentioned that Joe Biden is really worried about the 2024 election and he's afraid to have any kind of conversation with Iran. He shouldn't be afraid of Iran. He should be afraid of Netanyahu. It's the conversations he's not having with Netanyahu that are going to hurt him in 2024, not any conversation he has with Iran. I mean, makes me crazy.
The canary in the coal mine was the primary vote in Michigan, where 13% of the vote went to uncommitted. Now, if Biden can't win Michigan, Hillary Clinton lost Michigan by about 10,000 votes. Biden won it by 150,000 votes in 2020. He can't win by that kind of margin, I think, in 2024, and he could very well lose Michigan. If he loses Michigan, my guess is he's going to lose the election. And then we're going to wind up with the worst possibility. What Biden doesn't understand is that we have national security concerns that are different than Israeli concerns, and we have to act on those issues. And to allow their kind of immorality and their illegality and the apologetics that we engage in for them is really unconscionable.
Well, let me just stop you here because I'm going to challenge you on that. I think that our need for security and for stability actually is what Israel needs for their security and stability. And what Bibi Netanyahu is doing is making them more vulnerable, more isolated, more insecure. They are not providing them with there's not going to be a moat around Israel. because you know what terrorism is. Terrorism can go around, fly under, whatever. They're inviting greater instability. And one of the things that really, we keep talking about the two-state solution right now, because of what Netanyahu has done and because the conservatives have so taken over Israel, the place where there is no appetite for a two-state solution now is what? It's Israel. It's Israel. They're so afraid. But yet that fear is only sort of cultivating more fear and more hostility.
But one of the problems that, and we can't resolve this, that Israel is dealing with, is they've never really had a political class. If you look at the prime ministers, virtually every one of them has been a member of the official military or owns their loyalty to the military or supports the idea of the Israeli Defense Forces. They are a national security state. To a large degree. And as long as you have that, you don't have a progressive liberal political cast. You once had that in Israel with the Histadrut, with the labor movement, with the European immigration of Ashkenazi Jews from Europe. But all that's gone. It's a different Israel now. Yet we don't treat those differences. We don't understand those differences. So I see it even without Netanyahu, it's going to get worse before it gets worse. Until we realize that and use the pressure, the only pressure we have is our arms leverage. If we continue to just pour in offensive arms that they use illegally and immorally, they're going to take us down with them. And a Biden defeat in November would be taking us down. No question of that.
Oh no, I've been saying this. It's my mantra. It's my mantra from the very beginning. And yet, as I'm listening to you, I'm trying to figure out what is the trigger for Joe Biden to say, "I'm stopping sending military aid." That's it. You hear it from now a growing chorus in Congress. You are now hearing it from supposedly even his wife, you know, and then you find out about the arms they're sending literally the day after the World Central Kitchen. And what he doesn't understand is, as the chorus is getting louder and we're hearing more and more people saying it, and then he says, "I hear you, I'm angry, I'm upset too," and then you find out that the military equipment is still being sent, it undermines everything he says about everything. It doesn't stop and end with Joe Biden's comments about Gaza. Then you start asking yourself the same question about almost everything he says, because can his word be trusted? And the only way his word can be trusted is if he changes his actions.
And then when you get to the mainstream media, they engage in euphemisms that support Israel. This idea that there's a shadow war between Israel and Iran. It's not a shadow war. It's an undeclared war. And we better understand what Netanyahu is trying to do. So ever since the, 2015, 2016, the cyber attack that the United States and Israel made on Iran, the Stuxnet virus, to stop their centrifuge program. And now when you look at the various military confrontations that Israel has engaged in Damascus, we've been involved in Baghdad. It's you still have a worsening situation on the northern border with Lebanon. It's time to call a timeout to this. And only the United States and Iran can do it. That's the dialogue that has to take place. But I think we're afraid to engage in it.
We are. And again, I want to go back to your incredible piece that, you know, I'm so glad I took the time to read it. Meet the newest apologist for Israel, Rear Admiral John Kirby, because it exposes so much. But again, when asked about the fact that, you know, is Israel broken any humanitarian laws in its bombing campaign? He said the Department of State had examined the various incidents involving civilian deaths and had found, can he say this with a straight face? No incidents violating humanitarian law. Did he really say that? Did he really say that?
No. Unbelievable. He said it, but it never got into the press. I used YouTube. I couldn't find the press conference anywhere because MSNBC didn't cover it. CNN didn't cover it. So I YouTubed the press conference. And it was unbelievable, the things that were said. You know, what Israel is doing is writing checks that Netanyahu expects the United States to cash. And the only way we can cash them is with CENTCOM. And I think we should have learned by now that the use of military force in the Middle East is what has partially put us in the situation that we're in now. So we've got to stop Netanyahu from writing checks. And the bombing in Damascus shows he's not willing to stop. I think he's now heating up the situation on the northern border with Lebanon, and he says he's got a date for Rafah. We've said that Rafah is a red line. If the civilians aren't protected, it's a red line. And then the White House staff backed away from that statement that Biden made. So I still don't believe the tipping point has been there. And as you say in raising the question, I don't know what that tipping point would be. I don't know
I
how much
know.
destruction Netanyahu has to be responsible for before we realize this man cannot be trusted and he must be stopped. And only the United States can do that.
And when you were mentioning writing checks, I didn't realize that you were going to be talking. I thought you were talking about AIPAC, because AIPAC is writing checks.
Well,
And
APAC
AIPAC,
is literally writing. I'm talking
yes,
about
literally right,
rhetorical
exactly.
checks.
So you were talking about saying, I,
And
well, wait a minute,
actually,
I've seen
a group,
AIPAC.
I used to write checks for J Street Lobby. I don't write those checks anymore. J
Oh,
Street
good.
Lobby can't even support a ceasefire. I mean, that shows you where the community is in the United States.
It's horrific, and people are dying. Meet the newest apologist for Israel, Rear Admiral John Kirby. We've been joined by Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, and a former CIA analyst. I guess thank you, but I'm so glad I read the piece. I'm
Thank
so
you.
glad.
Keep
You're
on
welcome.
keeping on. Keep
Yeah,
on
right.
what you're doing.
I know. I'm exhausted. I'm
There are not a
exhausted.
lot of voices out there.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You may